The world has gone insane. Cosplayers rule the conventions. Gamers dominate the tabletop and the internet. Sci-fi subjugates the movies, and fantasy rules the bookstore with an iron fist. Only one group can bring order to this unruly mob. A team of uber geeks, masters of the nerdly arts, trained for decades in the hobby shops and basements of the nation. Mobilized by the secret masters, they are the Department of Nerdly Affairs.
Hello, operatives, and welcome to the Department of Nerdly Affairs. I'm your host, Rob Patterson, here with my co-host, Don Chisholm.
A gazebo, I attack!
And tonight, we're going to be making an RPG, live and on the air. We decided that would be the most interesting and active way to discuss how you make RPGs is to do one. And we couldn't think of anyone else better to go through this weird and wonderful experiment with than Jack Ward. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Hey, thanks for having me back, guys. I am wondering if I should roll dice to see if I'm happy to be here or not. Which dice? Is it 6? Is it 20? I'm so confused.
It's 3d6, but you get a plus 2 modifier.
Okay.
Because of Don's charming wit.
I thought it was going to be 1 for each host.
Okay, that works too. I can live with that. Okay, plus 4 then, fine. So, Jack, you approached us recently, and you discussed the idea of you want to make a role-playing game, tabletop role-playing game, for your audio drama series, Biff Straker. And yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about Biff Straker, just so the audience has an idea where we're starting from?
Yeah, and by the way, Don has been very kind in giving me some hints about making action figures for Biff Straker. So Biff Straker is going to be a bunch of everything, coloring books, comics, novels, audio drama. I'm hoping it'll be a big thing. So
cool.
You got to think of Biff Straker in the same sort of vein as Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers. That's where he came from. He started off in the 20th century in Guelph University sometime in the 80s. Sounds familiar. And ends up shunted far into the distant future where he wakes up on Earth, and Earth is now a place filled with creatures that look like they've come straight out of an H.G. Wells novel. They're all animal people of one kind or another. Human beings are not allowed on the Earth. The humans have moved to the moon. And make things even more interesting, the entire solar system has been reorganized. All the planets have Earth-like gravity. The entire space is covered in a breathable atmosphere. So imagine a breathable atmosphere that goes all the way across the solar system. So you go from planet to planet via flying machines. So there's no such thing as space as far as they know. The only person who's aware of this is Biff going, you know, where did the empty void go? And everybody else who's there, every planet is different. They have different cultures. There's Nazi tiger men of Mars. The human beings on Luna, the moon, are part of a space command kind of group called Nova Command. And so it's lots of action, lots of high fun risk. I wanted to make this. I know role-playing games can be very strategic or you know, very, very rules-oriented in that way. I like the idea of having a flexibility of, you know, hitting different body parts and such like that, but more from the perspective of, you know, high adventure. So fast-paced storytelling with roles that help define, you know, actions and encounters. And I love the idea of using different abilities to try stuff, you know. So Biff, you know, has very little skill in mechanical, but if the ship is failing, he has a chance to be able to fix it and maybe throw in some kind of luck roll for it as well. So those kinds of things I've always enjoyed.
Okay, I think that's pretty clear. So we're going for a high adventure. I'm still puzzling over the whole air space thing, but okay, sure. Well, I think we can work with this.
Well, there's a whole reason behind it, so I don't want to blow 7 years of this. There's a reason why it's called the I think it's called the Helios or something. I forget what I call it. I'll have to go and look up my actual name for it. And that's fine. We can name it later on. But the idea being there's actually these big monolithic kind of stone structures on each planet. And nobody knows where they came from. They're very antique and ancient. So there's really no aliens, but there are a lot of human beings that have been modified into all kinds of alien-like creatures. Right. I told you on the planet, they're called the Moravian Council, which is a little joke or a play on for the island of Dr. Moreau, of course. Mm-hmm. And they have their own sort of groupings of people. There's the rat men that, you know, are running around in the squalor of what was Guelph. And there's the hound dogs that are that are patrolmen that go around making sure, you know, they look sort of like German shepherds in like mech armor. Not like robot mech armor, but more like space marines kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's of course the evil Octopine, which is you're sort of like illithids from D&D. They're these human-like octopus head creatures that are quite evil, living out in the water. So there's all these kind of creatures. Mm-hmm. And then the idea is that eventually Biff will help bring all these disparate planets together. I have Amazon, was it Amazon Centaur Viking pirate women who fly along on these massive kite-like galleons through the sky, attacking various ships, so war galleons. There's, huge bear people and falcon men, and you name it. Straight out of the Flash Gordon kind of
thing. Right,
film.
Yeah, okay.
So it's a really wide, you know, widespread palette, which is great. I've got a planet that's set up for clockwork stuff. Mm-hmm. Which tends to be sort of like steam-powered, steampunk sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of opportunity for, and that's the thing is, it's got to be whatever system we have. Mm-hmm. It's got to have a little bit more of that GURPS feel, where it's got to be able to be flexible enough that you can do a lot of different things with it.
Well, one thing that strikes me as you're listing off all these different races is how important is it that they're rules-wise represented as being really different, or are they all basically, you know, humans just wearing outfits? Basically, are there differences cosmetic, or are there differences significant so they need to truly be represented in the rules?
Oh, and I should point out there, I guess there are all sorts of monsters too that are developed too through genetic manipulations too. So giant spiders and giant stuff like that. So we have an opportunity for monster stuff like that. That is a really good question, because they operate as humanoid like creatures. So, I think of Traveler.
Right.
And Vargers, you know, in Traveler, and Aslan in Traveler, which are kind of like Lion Man, the Aslan, and the Vargers are kind of like werewolf men kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They ended up not being too different in their stats from human beings. They got their bonuses and their minuses based upon their species. And I think that would be a cool thing if you're doing character creation, to sort of have, you know, maybe a little table of some variety of species, or sort of make your own species based on some of the aspects. Because, you know, if you got a creature with massive canines, well, they or massive claws, they might have some bonuses when it comes to hand to hand and stuff like that. So
but that could just be an extra plus one or plus two or something like to clawing damage or something like that. It doesn't have to be something big. And in fact, my concern would be that if we start going down the, how do we design all these species, that can quickly turn to a rabbit hole.
Absolutely.
And I think it's better to take something more of the Gamma World approach, shall we say, where, there's all these different weird abilities and stuff like that, but really they're just small modifiers on the basic character for the most part, because they're mostly cosmetic.
For sure.
Okay, and Don had something you wanted to say.
Oh, by the way, before he says something, it's called the Ethereum Field, A-E-T-H-E-R-I-U-M, the Ethereum Field, which has all the it's a massive breathable atmosphere that goes all the way to Pluto and beyond.
So, oh, okay. Mm. Handy. All right, so okay, but so that's my concern anyway, is that sure. We don't want to turn it into a game that's just about, you know, creating these incredibly detailed and complex characters, especially since I think you want something that's light and fast and easy to make.
I agree.
Yeah, you guys are both kind of, if you want to take the idea of role-playing game design, you're kind of jumping ahead of yourselves.
Probably.
At the moment. Because the first things you got to ask, and it this is where role-playing game design ties in with writing, but it's writing from the other kind of side of the fence. It's backwards writing. Because the first thing you got to kind of set up in your mind when you're putting together a game is, and me and Rob were talking about this, not like last week, it's the concept of what's your point?
True.
And what I mean, is a lot of people take that when writing to mean like what's the theme, the moral, that kind of thing. And it's part of it, but it's also the idea of, why are you putting this together, and what is the audience supposed to get out of it? Now, it's already come up for the game that it's supposed to be action-packed, fast-moving. So that gives you the theme. That gives you kind of the idea of what you want to work towards. You don't want something rules-heavy, but you need mechanics that will bring across the flavor of what it is you want to get from the components of your story.
Yeah, and if I could, what I was shooting for was the same kind of feel that you would get in the old-fashioned serials. I originally wanted to call this pulp because I thought the idea pulp is pretty broad, right? But it is, you know, it can be sword and sorcery, it can be space adventure, it can be aerial adventures, it can be crime drama kind of thing. But it has this really high action, you know, cliffhanger kind of stuff, which, you know, it's weird because some people die, but most people don't, right? You know, most people survive the battles, but I mean, like the bystanders can end up being killed in these kinds of things, but generally the heroes somehow find a way out, right? So it's not designed to be, you know, like some of the horror show, role-playing games you had beforehand about, you're not going to survive. Or Paranoia, which is always a great one, right? You know, be prepared to create 15 pulp heroes because they're all going to die. No, that's not the plan for this story in this world. Lots of fun, right? You know, that kind of genuine fun that you had playing those games. Because let's be honest, even when we were kids, playing D&D in those games really... Those kind of early games were pulpish for us, in a way.
Not am I speaking out of turn? They're pulp absolutely to their core. I mean, those things are written by people that grew up reading pulp magazines and stuff to one degree or another, and were heavily influenced by pulp science fiction. So there's no question that early role-playing games are absolutely very pulpy.
Right. So like Champions is incredibly pulpy.
Well, Champions is superhero-y, and remember, the superhero books, in a lot of ways, kind of come from the pulps.
Sure.
As we covered in our American Comics episode, you know, the pulps and the superhero comics and, of course, the superhero the superhero radio plays all kind of grew up around the same time, but I'd argue that the pulp heroes came first, and then the comic book versions came a little bit later. So I would argue that, the pulps had a huge influence on superhero stuff. And there was even a pulp resurgence going on during like the 70s and late 80s for a little while there when Champions was written. So I would argue that, the pulps, again, are a huge influence on Champions. In fact, there actually is a pulp hero role-playing game for Champions.
Cool.
They actually did that. In fact, I think that was one of their very first supplements they did for Champions was an actual pulp hero role-playing game.
Cool. And I think there's actually a bit of a pulp resurgence going on now with so many ebooks and the idea that people want to see more solar punk, which tends to be a really pulpy kind of high adventure, very positive expression of the future.
Right. Yeah, it would be nice to have a positive expression of the future. I agree.
Space Command. Isn't that what it's called? The Mark Cerce series that's coming out?
Yeah, there's that coming out. I don't know much about it, but I was thinking more of the Orville, actually. But okay, that works too.
Sure. Uh-oh. Sure, the Orville works.
Nerd fight coming, but anyway. See, now you've kind of got a good start. If you're doing a role-playing game, what I find the two things that sort of go together that you want to start looking at as your baseline is how do you want the mechanics to work and mm-hmm. characters.
Right.
Because you've got an idea of how you want it to play out, and now you think, in this setting, human being is the baseline, right?
Right.
So you start with that, put together a human, and when you're thinking of this in game terms, you'll have your mechanics, you'll have how the numbers work to resolve action.
Right.
But at this point, when you're putting together how a character's made, remember that if you're a writer, in your head you come up with circumstance, you come up with the rules of your setting, and you keep that in your mind when you're putting your story together. In a role-playing game, you have to do that explicitly on paper, because your characters, the players, are just going to get way out of hand. Those rules have to be external. And when you start picking how you make a character, what statistics you use, how they work, that starts giving you that focus. That's where you start putting the idea in the participants' heads, the participants being your characters if you were writing, about mm-hmm. how the universe works, what kind of things they want to do, what kind of things they're going to have to do in that.
Sure. So I was thinking when I was thinking that mm-hmm. if you imagine sort of three concentric circles that are connected, sort of like an Olympic symbol, but not the mm-hmm. Olympic symbol because I don't want to be sued.
You're talking about a Venn diagram?
Is that what it is? Yeah, oh, yeah, it is a Venn diagram. That's right, yeah. Well, Venn diagrams come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, but imagine three in a Venn diagram.
Yeah, circles. A Venn diagram with three circles, and so there are three circles, and how does it work?
One of them could be the physical element's body.
Mm-hmm.
One of them could be the mental aspects called mind.
Okay.
And then basically because this is a pulp thing, we need a spirit. Of mm-hmm. some sort.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which, you know, could eventually, I mean, it could be used for all sorts of alternative dimensional travel if you wanted to, or magic if you wanted to throw that in. But mm-hmm. ideally, it could, you know, it could also be a part of, like, luck or serendipity, let's call it, right? Mm-hmm. So I like the idea of the more heroic your character is, the more it provides these extra sort of little bonuses when the roles come in, and you really need it, right? Mm-hmm. In one way or another. So if, for example, in your body, if you have some sort of levels of the body, I wouldn't know what they would be, but we'd have to think about it. You got to think about things like stamina. Now, stamina could be an element within the interconnections part of the Venn diagram of spirit and body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And reflex, on the other hand, could be part of body and mind.
Okay.
And then maybe you could have resolve between mind and spirit.
Okay.
Which is kind of an interesting element that you could utilize. And then, you know, the center part gives you, you know, your maximum hit points, or whatever you want to call them, like if they're hit points or life points or whatever people call them, and maybe a default. Because here's the thing, too, that when we're talking about these kinds of games, mm-hmm. I like the idea of fisticuffs
mm-hmm.
Just as much as I like the idea of blaster fire, right? But yeah, the problem often when you make these kinds of games is, like, if you're doing hand-to-hand fisticuffs fighting in D&D, it's pretty boring comparatively. Right. You don't get the same kind of excitement, and it really turns out, well, yeah, so much of this is just going to stun him, and you'll actually only lose 10% of your hit points. And mm-hmm. it feels sort of deflating in some way. So mm-hmm. there should be a way to be able to have a really exciting combat system that includes somebody who's just going to go at it tooth and nail compared to somebody who's going to be doing sword battle or knives or blasters or something like that, to give that kind of high action feel. But I know we're jumping ahead because that's talking about resolving in combat.
Yeah.
But you still got to keep these things in mind when you're coming up with your character sheet too.
Yeah, because it all ties in. Like one of the things you've kind of hit on, when you look at, say, like your old school Dungeons & Dragons, any of the D20 systems, a lot of games, what they did is you're trying to keep a certain feel. Mm-hmm. And when you write a game, there's basically, I think we've mentioned this before, there's kind of three realities a role-playing game works in. It works in the reality of the story, the setting. Mm-hmm. It works in the reality of, like, the mechanics. And it works in the reality of the real world, that being, like, the players' expectations, their knowledge, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. One of the problems you run into with, like, your D&D games, like Jack was saying, punching somebody doesn't do a lot game-wise because all damage is a simple tally. You have hit points. When they reach zero, you're out. When they reach minus 10, you're dead. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to come up with a way using that mechanic to represent that I can punch you a lot and you won't die. Mm-hmm. I can stab you not nearly as much and you will die, or I can shoot you one or two times and you're probably dead.
Right.
And to work that, they just come up with different damage levels. So the fact that a gun or like a battle axe or that, mm-hmm. on average is more likely to do you a lot more harm than me just kicking you in the shin, it has a different amount of damage it does, but it all just comes off this tally. There are no secondary effects.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that starts where you get into this idea of the mechanics representing what the players expect and representing the setting. So a pulp setting, you punch anybody in the head, they pass out. That's just how it works.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of need a mechanic for knocking somebody out, mm-hmm. right away. That suggests the same ideas like with a stamina rating. If something happens to your character other than just an amount of damage gets tallied, that there's damage effects.
Right.
And you're kind of getting at that. When you look at how you've divvied up your stats, the body, spirit, mind, that suggests kind of a story angle because that's kind of the human dichotomy that since like the ancient Greeks and probably even before we used to, mm-hmm. to discuss what a human being is.
Mm-hmm.
Like those are the traits that the thinkers and your spirit would mean this and that. When you're doing a game, then you got to kind of start defining them and thinking about what that does. Mm-hmm. And then you compare that to, like, you're working off an established setting, so is that how the story works? And then can you tie that into what the participants are gonna see? Because part of the narrative of a role-playing game is the interaction of the mechanics and the play and mm-hmm. the perception of the participants. And I guess to put that into English, because that's kind of a mumbledy peg. You've mentioned champions.
Mm-hmm.
Champions to me had the problem that a lot of really complicated games have, that you had all kinds of numbers that don't directly key up to anything demonstrable in real life or in a story.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it difficult to wrap your head around in a narrative fashion what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got like your DCR and I'm subtracting my AV and I'm adding that to 11 and I'm rolling the dice with a modifier because the PPPC is Thursday, it's just kind of numbers and that they don't match up. If you're a participant, you're now thinking it strictly in rules terms.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a game like, say, Call of Cthulhu,
mm-hmm.
it uses very specific, like your attributes, strength. Well, I know what that is. Magic points. Well, that's how good I am at magic. Sanity points. Well, that's how I am or not. When the character takes an action, it's usually a percentage because you're usually rolling a skill.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
And, like, I'm going to try to talk that guy into something. Well, fast talk. It's easy for a participant, especially one who's a non-gamer, to put that together. I'm fast talking that guy, so he's fast talk. it's the same thing if you're doing, say, in Call of Cthulhu, I'm going to, like, use my magic powers to influence you while I cast my, you know, mind control spell, and you make a comparison of my magic point level mm-hmm. versus your like mind level. Well, it's a concept that it translates pretty easy story wise and non gamer. And if I fail my role, it's his mind was too powerful. My powers could not overcome him.
That's the kind of thing I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about instead of having like hard and fast numbers of how much hit point damage I can take or a character can take, why not have a series of different numbers that represent things like the amount of dice that you can roll based upon your skill, either in defense or whatever like that. And then the comparison between you, because part of the fun in playing these role-playing games is you rolling against somebody else, right? Mm-hmm. So, and so if I, let's say you're trying to fight proto-Nazis, and you're attacking these proto-Nazis, and you are not very skilled, but you still have, you know, you still have heart or whatever, and you can throw out your abilities into that. Maybe you can throw in an extra die of something, and you roll a 15, and they try to evade because they have a certain level to be able to do that, right? And they roll, end up a 10. Well, you're 5 over. And I thought, well, why not have things like, instead of just saying 5 points of damage, then maybe you have a little ruler of some sort, or some kind of line that sits there and says, this is your like success numbers, right? So if you succeed by up to 5, maybe that ends up being like, if you succeed by a certain number, maybe that ends up being a minor success, because then you can start identifying what a minor success is between a major success, between a critical success.
Right.
And similarly, you can do the same thing with a minor failure, a failed attempt, and a major and a critical failure, because those are all easy to interpretation from the cinematographic or the pulpy kind of thing, right? So
right.
It's like, you know, a minor failure could be, oh, your gun jammed, right, for this round, right. And you have to be able to, you know, do something else instead. So having those kinds of things, whereas, a major success could end up being, I don't know. I don't know what the result would be that would end up being, harming him to a certain degree, or maybe that's when you start rolling, you know, die damages based upon the level of the success it is to sort of start being down. I was watching UFC just a couple of days ago, and how this one guy like just wound up and just clocked this guy, and his head did a complete 360 up and down, and he fell right back, and his lights were out, and that happens. Right? Mm-hmm. But if you're playing D&D and you get above, like, you know, level 12, that never happens, right? You can't take somebody out unconscious in one punch. It's just impossible, basically. But there still should be that capability, because that happens to superheroes all the time. I mean, not superheroes, to the heroes in pulp world. Right, they get knocked unconscious all the time, too. They don't have glass jaws or anything, but somebody comes up behind them, of course, cowardly, hits them in the back of the head with a plank, right? Take him to the lab, Igor, kind of thing. So,
yeah, everyone in pulp has glass neck. That's their vulnerability that comes, every pulp hero has automatically. If you're hit from behind, you just automatically go unconscious.
Well, and there's skill things, right? Like you can, I like some games have, you know, benefits versus weaknesses or detriments of some sort. And that allows you to have like more skill attributes when you're building your character to do that. If you're going to take a couple of really bad flaws, well, that can maybe, you know, really build your character in other ways too. And that's kind of fun too, because that also builds more to the story. I mean, usually your character, your main hero in pulp is, you know, some kind of square-jawed football star. But they don't all have to be. Mm-hmm. And you also end up having, sometimes you have a whole cadre of heroes, a la The Shadow or Doc Samson. Is it Doc Samson?
Doc Savage.
Doc Samson, someone else. Doc
Samson was from the Hulk.
Yeah, that's right. I was going to say that was a Marvel hero, I remember. Yeah, Doc Savage. Mm-hmm. You know, they have their people that come along. And just as a little shout out to Broken Sea, that Jake Samson. There you go. Jake Samson has his crew as well. So finding that ability, to me, that's key, because you have to be able to have something that's fair, but also something that allows you to, and when I say fair, somebody's got to be able to look at the stats, see the role, and go, oh yeah, that totally works, or that, you know, that totally happened, and they can't complain that it's too difficult. Like, if you think about Car Wars, for example, I mean, you had 3 points, so everybody bought improved body armor because it gave you 6 extra points. It was the only way you could be sure that you might survive an encounter, because nobody would have 3 points, because 1 point of damage, you're wounded, 2 points, you're unconscious, and 3 points, you're dead. So it was crazy.
Yeah.
That's what my thinking. What do you think?
You hit upon a couple of things, because you can see now, you have to find your in, and I always like to start with the character sheet and the mechanics, because they go together, and that's a start. Because what you're getting at now is, how much of a participant is the game master and the player going to be in the action? One of the problems with D&D and a lot of games in general is, when the fight starts, I'm not really strategizing. I'm picking my most damage inflicting weapon and rolling until I hit and you fall down. With the kind of system you've suggested with levels of success, that's a really good thing for the game master, because it makes the game master a really active participant, because they're going to provide the flavor, they're going to provide the scene, they're going to provide the laws of physics for how the action goes based on the role.
Right.
That works out really good. As a game master, you kind of need some flexibility, because you're going to be coming up with all kinds of stuff. But it puts that opportunity out there. A lot of games are just succeed or fail. And you can still interpret the role as game master how you want. But this, it's like I said before, now your mechanic is suggesting it. It's pointing everybody in that direction. The next thing you want to kind of work on is, how much is the player going to participate? Like, a lot of games, the strategizing for the player happens when they make their character, but when the action starts, you're using the statistics, the skills that you picked, but you're kind of just picking the most appropriate one and going with it. There's not a lot of, like, maneuvering or plotting or planning or that. That's happening on the fly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tricky thing. You don't see too many games that do that, because it's tough, and it requires... You bridge that gap in a weird way between like borderline war game and narrativist game.
Mm-hmm.
A good way of doing it that I've seen a few games do is, I'll use the example of the Cartoon Action Hour.
Mm-hmm.
That your character, there are no set statistics, so not everybody has a strength rating. Your character's stats are basically a couple of lines that define them. So like we say, I am Muscleor, King of the Muscle Barbarians, and King of the Muscle Barbarians is your stat.
Mm-hmm.
You can take like flex mightily at +5 as a trait, and traits add to rolls, and then what happens during the game is, before you drop the dice, basically the player and the game master whine and wheedle about what's appropriate. So if I can somehow work flex mightily into the action, I get that bonus to my roll. And that keeps the player active, because the player has to come up with the justification for how the numbers work. It lets the player strategize, and it can be a really, really good, like, imagination workout and way for the player, not the character, to contribute. Because you can take a game like that and just twist it until it cries, and that's cool, because, again, it makes the player active. We have to find out where the post office is. I will ask a citizen. Okay, what do you do? I get my flex mightily bonus. Well, how the hell do you get your flex mightily bonus? Asking for directions. who am I asking? Well, it looks like there's these like two office women, early 20s, coming back from lunch. Well, I'm going to try to impress them with my physique. I flex mightily as I ask, morning ladies, where might I find the post office? And it's the kind of thing you could see happening in a story. So it bridges that story and mechanics gap. The player got to come up with something on their own. It lets them utilize the stuff that they strategize making the character, and it keeps the game moving. It keeps that exchange between the player and the game master.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, that's something, again, to a big thing to consider is how much of a participant are the players going to be once things get rolling. Mm-hmm. And that's where, if you put something in, like you were talking, the levels of success or failure, one of the nice things you can suggest that works is let the player contribute to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, hold on a sec. I think we've jumped... I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think we might have accidentally jumped the step.
Okay.
And what I mean by is this. There's a certain... Okay, the rules, as Don is fond of saying, represent the physics of the setting and physics of the game world and everything, etc. But one of the things you have to determine right from the beginning, and Jack should know this full well because he comes from an audio drama background, is you have to determine how solid the setting is. By which I mean, is the setting mostly a collection of ideas? And, you know, the actual things like the locations and everything is kind of fluid. It just depends. It's almost more dreamlike, shall we say. You know, more just, you know, more about the ideas, shall we say. More ideal. Or is it a very solid place where everything has its location? And, like, in audio drama, for example, that would be an audio drama where you make it very clear exactly where all the characters are sitting. And you have, like... as the characters walk around, you can hear them walking around. You can hear the locations of everything. Like, it's very, everything is very solid, you know, in this world. Hmm. As opposed to a story where, you know, even the scenes kind of blend together. Because the whole point is not really where everything is. The point is actually the ideas and the feeling that everything's getting or being given, as the case may be. Sorry to mix two genres there, but I hope that might make some sort of sense.
Yep.
So, for example, Cartoon Action Hour, for example, isn't trying to represent a solid physical reality. It's trying to represent this mercurial, dreamlike world of Saturday morning, or more like, you know, after-school cartoons like Transformers and G.I. Joe and other ones like that. And so, how strong are they? Well, it doesn't really matter. I mean... It can literally change depending on the story and the writer, and so who cares? I mean, the whole point is the actions that they take and where those actions look cool and how they affect the story and everything. But the actual physical world is not really that important, okay? So that's why there are no physical attributes, say, as Don was saying, in Cartoon Action Hour. There's not solid attributes like body and mind and spirit because it's not really important. It really isn't. What's important is how we're reflecting the flow of the story. It's more of a narrativist thing, okay? And then on the other extreme, of course, we've got games like, what would be a good example of, like, Solid As You Can Go, not maybe GURPS. The Tri-Tac system?
GURPS.
Okay, GURPS will do, yeah. I don't know, I'm thinking the one that, what did Richard Choholka make?
That was Tri-Tac.
That was Tri-Tac, okay, like Moro Project and everything like that. I think that was Tri-Tac, yeah, where there's all these stats and all these skills, you know, in incredible detail. And GURPS can be like that, too, if you play it hardcore, mm-hmm. okay? And everything is exactly, and we know the exact details of the world in the smallest degree. We know how, you know, how many inches that guy's finger is, and we know all this stuff. And the world is a solid, solid place, mm-hmm. okay? And at that point... it becomes like this worst, okay, we're really looking at a simulation of reality, but it's just this reality.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So one is a simulation of a reality, and the other is a simulation of a story, more of a story type.
Right.
And this is something, and there are games that come in between.
Right.
I notice, based on what you're talking about, that you seem to be at least a little bit influenced when you're talking about successes, like by the White Wolf type stuff. Like the Vampire, the Masquerade, and everything, because they were the first game to really use the whole, you know, you roll a d10, and if you get, what is it, under 7, isn't it, you get a success? I think it is.
Seven.
Something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was, you rolled
7 or higher?
Yeah, you're the number D10 you dropped equaled your stat.
Right.
Every I think it was 6 or higher was a success, and then the number of successes that you got dictated how well you did.
Exactly, yeah. So that's the feel I'm getting from what you were talking about, Jack, earlier.
Yep.
And that is a kind of in-between. That is, you know that World of Darkness, I would
you
say,
you know what
is
another
kind of
in-between that I really enjoyed as a system, and you guys haven't mentioned it yet, is the D6 system. Like, just the straight D6 system. I found that one of the more flexible systems to be able to play basically anything and still keep a sense. Because there is a part of me that likes my stats. Right? There is a part of me that when I like to role play, because I've done, you know, freeform role playing where you're just sort of making things up as you go along, and you often do that online with people in, you know, in forums and stuff like that if you're playing those kind of role playing games that way. But I don't want to be bogged down with things like, like Palladium and, where even like the old stuff of like, certain degree, Space 1889 was terrible for that. And I love that game, but it was weird how the hand-to-hand combat system was entirely different than the actual, firearms, or the missile-based side of the combat system. And then the aspect of identifying wounds was so much more different than the aspect of the actual combat system itself. There should be ways of being able to deal with these situations and these conflicts in one way or another, really simply by somebody sitting there saying, "Okay, this is your number of dice that you can roll, or this is your skill level that modifies whatever dice you're rolling," and here are the modifiers that's going to make it more difficult. Right? Mm-hmm. You got to jump over a wall. There's a fire going on overhead. They're playing the Star Spangled Banner while they're dropping Cupid dolls made of razor blades. I don't know what it is, but these kind of the weird things that come to my head.
tell us more. Tell us about your thoughts.
You say this, but you're a writer too, and the weird stuff comes to your head as well.
I know.
I like the fact that a good system in my mind helps you tell the story. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Helps you identify, like I said before, like minor failures, major failures. So you can sit there and you can go, "Oh, what would that turn out to be? Oh, in this particular circumstance, absolutely your gun would have misfired and blew you backwards," right? That makes sense. Okay, cool. And based upon this kind of failure and the distance between you and this guy, then this is the kind of damage that would absolutely take place. And the more it can be easy and yet and clear, but also not so easy that it's just, well, you roll 6-sided die no matter what, the same 6-sided die with no modifiers, and if you get a 1, you always lose, and if you get a 6, you always win.
Right. But I think Don's actually hit on the right thing for what you're talking about, where I think it should be a system, that's just my take, of course, which is, again, is in between what I was talking about, the two extremes, and is one, but that actually leans more towards the dreamlike or the story side. I actually think that you should try to set up a system where the player should be negotiating with the GM about, well, what if I use this skill or what if I use this ability to get bonuses and to try to increase the number of dice that they roll? Because that's one of the nice things about success-based systems, as we were talking about. It does allow for that open flexibility. I've seen a couple of different games do different versions of that.
Sure.
And they can actually work really well because they make the player much more active. The player is always looking for, well, what if, what if I, jump over the fence at him and use that to use the fence post to help, give my kick a little extra strength.
Sure.
It's like, okay, you can have an extra 2d10 for your roll on that kind of success roll on that kind of thing, or damage roll, whatever. The key point is that you want the player to be looking for those active bonuses and to reward quick and clever play, because that's what you want, right? You want them to be active, you want them to be engaged, and you want them to be having fun. And it makes the story more lively.
It kind of reminds me of Xena. Remember Xena, the warrior princess?
Yes,
I remember one particular episode. I didn't see them all. I'm going to keep saying that if people ask me. But
yeah, keep saying that, Jack. Keep saying that.
Yeah, I only
that,
caught it a couple of times. But the times I did, I remember one particular episode specifically when She's going to do this particular plan, and I forget what's the name of her female companion. She says to her, "But don't you remember we did this at this time," kind of thing. And her response was basically, "Never do the same thing twice," you know, with a big smile on her face, which was a nod to all writers, right? Because it's just the idea is that you should always come up with something new and inventive. And in some ways, that might be also, you know, not just a bonus, but a negative. You guys play. Oh, you did that exact same tactic last game. You could get a negative for that, or no bonus this time around because it's not unique enough or it's not clever enough in that respect.
Well, what you can do is you can just simply say that bonus for attack for you coming up with that particular combo only applies that one time.
Yeah,
and you can only use that once per combat or something like that. That trick. It prevents someone from using the same trick over and over and over again and expecting to get great bonuses out of it every time.
I mean, Neo picking up a really big cement thing and killing like 500 different Agent Smiths with it continually for 10 minutes.
I mean, under circumstances like that, I can see where it's a weapon, so it would give him bonuses for that kind of thing. But I'm talking about, doing the same tactic or the same trick just every single time. It's like, and also you wouldn't be able to do it against people that you've fought before because they know what you're going to do. So in that case, it might even turn into a negative or you might lose something if you try it against someone you've done it to before. But whatever. The key point is, that's just a simple rule that you can't do the same trick more than once or get the same bonus more than once per combat. So it forces them to constantly be thinking of new ways to get that. And you've got to think about how you're going to encourage them to get those bonuses.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, you guys have kind of hit on something to get into like what Rob said. A derivation of that is you always have to remember, and this is why when you're writing a game, you have to kind of picture the setting and how things should work, because no system is going to be able to do everything properly.
Right.
Well, that's true. Yeah, you're basically going to end up being a master of none if you try to do everything.
Which you can... You can do. I've seen games, but a good example...
It's called GURPS.
Yeah, well, a good example of the kind of thing is if you take, say, Shadowrun and Cyberpunk. They're both Cyberpunk settings. They both have a lot of the same trappings in that. But Shadowrun ends up playing much, much, much more cinematically than Cyberpunk does. Mm. And it works because Shadowrun is supposed to be a more cinematic thing. It's more about the story. It's more about the action. Whereas in Cyberpunk, at least the first couple of editions, the technology is actually a big part of the story.
Yes.
How it works is a big part of the story. The development, what it does, the ups, the downs. And to reflect that in a game, if the technology is part of it, you have to have a system that it puts kind of I can give you an example that'll explain it, but you have to have a system that's going to flesh out the technology enough that it feels like something. And the example I use, I bring those two up because if you think about gunfights, in Cyberpunk, a gun does X dice of damage and armor blocks Y amount of damage. So if a guy's wearing full hard armor, and I've got a handgun. Hard armor has like a stopping power of 40. A handgun does like 2d6 damage. I cannot put a hole in that guy's armor no matter what I do. And that works because the technology is the focus. And if you've got this super, super modern body armor, a 9mm round does not have the mass or the force to penetrate it, period, ever. Shadowrun being more cinematic, your body armor doesn't give you an all-out defense like that. The way the mechanics work is when you're hit, every weapon has a base level of damage. Every two successes that the guy gets when he shoots you adds to a level to that damage. You get a body roll that every two successes you get drops the level of damage. Armor makes that roll easier. But it doesn't provide... So I could be wearing super awesome hard armor, and if I flub my roll and you roll really well, you could shoot right through it with that 9mm pistol. Which is not...
Which is very cinematic.
It is. Yeah. Happens movies all the time. Doesn't happen in real life, But because that's where the games are supposed to go, because they're both cyberpunk, Shadowrun's more cinematic, it has more of an upbeat thing, there's positive parts. Cyberpunk is cold, hard reality, and you're screwed. Remember, that's one of the sayings in the game. Everything is recyclable, even you. It keeps, the mechanics keep kind of that flavor going on an almost subliminal level, because I'm betting that a lot of people who've partaken of both have never stopped to look at it that way.
Right.
That what happens in Shadowrun is your equipment is an add-on to your character, whereas in Cyberpunk, your equipment is a thing unto itself.
Yes. Yeah.
And this is where you'd have to, like, if you're doing, especially if you're doing, like, your pulp-style game, pulp stories are full of mad scientists, and you have to sort of ask yourself, is the equipment going to be the Cyberpunk thing where it's its own thing, or is it basically just an add-on to the character?
That's a big thing, too, because one of the things I absolutely adore about Space 1889 that I've never seen in another game, but I haven't played as many games as you have, Don, and maybe even you have, Rob. I don't know how many you've played, but
a few.
Space 1889, you want to be an inventor.
Yeah.
Because it's so much fun inventing stuff, and there's a really cool system to be able to make stuff. To be fair, if you're going to have something in a pulp system, you really need to have that ability for that kind of character class. Because there's the strong-jawed guy, but there's also the scientist hero, too. There's a bunch of different hero types, right? And the scientist hero, or even the strong-jawed guy, can possibly have some science ability or inventor's ability. There's really this feel that everybody could be an inventor back in the day of pulps, right? And you should be able to have some of your skills be able to produce some really kooky stuff if you have the creativity to be able to make it, you know? And I love the idea that in Space 1889 they have like a reliability factor to the weapon that you make. So, you know, you fire it and if you don't make your reliability, it explodes or it doesn't work or something like that. But it just adds to that extra kind of flavor of a really cool story, and it adds to the tension too. Like, I don't know, I made this freeze ray, but guys, it was really fast and I don't know if it's gonna work, right? As opposed to I made this freeze ray and it's gonna totally work from now until the end of time, right?
Right.
So I'd love to be able to add that aspect to it as well.
Well, that's actually not that difficult. What you do is you, for example, just your freeze ray example, you would set up a system where the player would roll their invent. And I don't know, I'm the one out of the three of us that hasn't read Space 1889. If this is how they do it, okay, you know, mea culpa. Anyway, but I would set it up so that when you're making it, there's a difficulty based on how complex the, you know, of course, building this freeze ray is for you. But then you can take modifiers to make it easier. Like, for example, making it less reliable makes your roll to create it easier. You know, giving it less, say, charges, for example, where it has less shots per whatever, per, you know, clip or whatever, that will make the creating it easier because you're basically building in flaws. You know, you're building flaws at the rolling stage and planning stage just to make things faster and easier.
Yeah, and so building it in Star Labs makes your reliability a lot higher too, right? So where you do it makes that big difference as well. What tech level you're operating on and which world, because different worlds, this is another neat thing that Traveler did was tech levels on worlds, right? So it gave you this idea that if I show up in this world, I'm dealing with Conan the Barbarian technology. But if I show up in this world, I'm dealing with, you know, psionics and cybernetics. So it kind of gave you a bit of a feel of where you're landing and what's going on. So almost like tech levels can give you bonuses in die modification for those kinds of things.
Right. Yeah. Although that's a setting consideration, so we should probably leave that a little to the side at this point. Things like tech levels, for example.
It kind of ties into all of it.
It does, but I think we're not quite settled on the actual resolution and character sheet and everything yet. That's actually the next, I would argue that's a step or two ahead of where we are right now still. I mean, depending on how you want to do this, of course.
I think you're totally right, but when you're writing a role-playing game, you do make these big leaps because, again, you're trying to tie it all in.
Yeah, that's true.
The inventing thing in Space 1889, a big part of the setting is that who the hell was it? No, it wasn't Thomas Edison. The guy who invented the liftwood galleon in Space 1889.
Wasn't Tesla.
It was Edison.
Edison. Yeah. He didn't do the liftwood. He did the ether propeller.
Yeah, and then that sparks this whole it's like the mad scientist revolution. And a theme of the game is that everybody and his brother in their garage is building one of these spaceships and mechanical men and that. And the rules take that into account, because to be an inventor, you can be a mediocre inventor in that game just by picking a couple of skills. Yes, it just takes a couple of points, and now I can do something. To be a great inventor is a big investment of like your initial like points allocations and that. But they have that idea that anybody can maybe come up with something. Mm-hmm. And it fits the setting. It's kind of, to go back to my Shadowrun cyberpunk thing, in Shadowrun they have the Matrix, which is like the internet you plug into. It's the, what the hell they call it? The net in cyberpunk.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In Shadowrun, to be able to enter the Matrix, I just need a head jack. Head jacks are fairly cheap money-wise, and the essence cost, the amount of your humanness that you lose, is really small. So right. In Shadowrun, again, being more cinematic, you can make a character who's like a tough fighting guy and a magic user and like a netrunner.
Mm-hmm.
The cost for that, he won't be quite as good a magic user as a dude who doesn't have any cybernetics at all. Mm-hmm. But he'd be competent at it, and you can run the net, because it's supposed to be, you've got all this neat shit and everybody can partake. Whereas again, when you get to cyberpunk, netrunner is a specific class. You need the skill to do it, which means you have to be a netrunner, which means you can't be a solo or a media if you do it. And again, it's that idea that because it's specialized technology, not everybody has the training and experience to use it. It becomes its own thing. So that separates that. Now it becomes another rules concern. It becomes a running concern. But it lends itself to that idea that technology is more solid. Going when you get to like the mad scientist Space 1889 thing, the technology is kind of solid, but there's a lot of wiggle room, because the idea is people are coming up with whole new things every like month. And you need a mechanic that takes that into account.
Right.
Being the writers that we are, part of me wants to see these done almost like they do in Toon in scenes, right?
Uh-huh.
You know? So if you're creating an adventure, you would break it down into scenes, and that way you could end up having, you know, your high points and low points in your scene design of the story kind of thing.
Right.
And cliffhangers. But that also means then that you could effectively put in things called setting modifiers.
Right.
Right? Based upon where the scenes take place. So the setting modifiers would, you know, represent a number of different positive and negative things based upon what you were trying to roll, right? So,
yeah.
You know, if you're trying to, you know, trying to use philosophy against a barbarian... because the setting tech level is caveman, it's not going to work as effectively as if it was somewhere else, right? So,
and that, yeah, and you could definitely work stuff like that in. Yeah, you can definitely work stuff like that in. But actually, something occurred to me as I was listening to Don talk.
Don talks a
when
lot.
When you talk about your, yeah, Don does talk a lot. That occurred to me too. But one thing is, I was thinking about the attributes you mentioned earlier about, you know, body, spirit, mind, and then you mentioned about stamina, reflex, and resolve, and the how they all kind of, there's no creativity stat in there. Like, what you set up is a dichotomy that's both fairly solid. I mean, you can work with it, but by itself, okay, how can I put this? It has no flavor by itself. The problem with the body, mind, spirit dichotomy that you've got set up as your attributes right now is they have no flavor. They're generic and they're bland the way things are. In fact, the only way that they're oriented right now is 100% almost, despite spirit and mind being there, it's still mostly oriented towards physical. It's still oriented more towards the square-jawed physical hero type thing. It's not oriented towards like the creative weedy guy or the other types of characters. And it doesn't have flavor to it. And I guess that would be that's my major thing I was thinking about, where, because I was thinking about the dichotomy between, say, the smart guy and the creative guy. And maybe they could be the same person, but often in pulp, they're not really, because everyone really has their own role, right? The Mad Inventor has his shtick, the heroic guy has his shtick, the damsel in distress has her shtick, whatever that happens to be.
I think what you're talking about, see, in my original idea about this, that's sort of a template for how you would look at combat resolution, right? But if you're talking about all the various flavors that come in, well, those are the modifiers that pop up based upon, you know, the kind of character that you have and the kind of ability. That's where the flavor comes in, is in the skills and the background and the modifiers kind of stuff.
So you didn't mention that. So that's your plan, is to have these root body, mind, spirit attributes and everything. And then there'll be a whole bunch of modifiers based on the type of character.
Well, I thought that'd be kind of cool. But I mean, you could look at things like, you know, muscle and body and stamina and agility and dexterity and intelligence and willpower, you know, and luck, right, and all those kinds of things that normally show up as character stats in a particular thing. Mm-hmm. Instead of having those as stats, you could use those as sort of large pools. You know how in D&D they have like proficiency, like things to pull from in large categories. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you had a character that is, you know, a scientist, you're not going to be pulling some of the skills from the muscle or the body area, but you might want to pull certain ones from, well, agility and intelligence and willpower and, you know, like the intelligence one can include everything from, you know, disguise to psychology to hard science and medicine and linguistics and first aid and, you know, expert ability in something, you know, and giving them the ability to sort of, that's where you start to build those character traits that make them more interesting in that respect. And maybe that's where you start also putting in some of your flaws under these larger categories, right? So I wouldn't know what we would come up with, but I'm sure I could go look up generic flaws for characters and start pooling those down. The internet is such great stuff for that nowadays. Remember when we were younger and we were like, we couldn't do any of this stuff on the internet. Now it's just like, what do I do? Oh, let's just look up like 1,000 different synonyms for willpower, right? You know, and suddenly it's there, right? Yeah. Right in front of you. It's kind of scary.
Yeah, I remember spending weeks coming up with advantages and disadvantages for a homebrew role-playing game back when I was like 16 and there was no internet.
Right.
So you have to think about all, you have to go through all your game books and see the ones they came up with and think about other ones. And it's a giant, it's a giant research mess where now you just look up, okay, I need flaws for role-playing games. Okay, there they are. And there's lists of the generic ones online and you just pick the ones you think are best suit what you've got to, what you're going with, and you go for it. Okay, now I'm starting to see how you're starting to put this together. So the body, mind, spirit thing, those are really kind of like pools, basically, and then they combine with your character modifiers. So, for example, let's say I had Inventor, okay? So I was I had Inventor level 3. I don't know what your levels are. I'm just going to riff this off. So I had Inventor level 3, okay? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to invent an invention, or create an invention, whatever, how that works. Create an invention. So I would combine my Inventor level 3 with, say, my mind, which same is 4, and that would give me 7 dice to roll. So, and maybe I might add a skill to that. You know, maybe I have mechanics if I'm building something mechanical, and let's say that's a 2, and so I end up with a 9 at this point. That would give me 9 dice to roll to try to successfully, I don't know, rewire this car or rewire this ether engine or whatever.
Right.
Is that basically what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Am I getting the right idea?
But here's, and maybe you guys can talk about this and Don can talk about this as well. Here's my biggest problem with levels is that levels always end up doing one of two things. Either they level out and you can't get any higher, or they get to a point where people create super god characters based upon levels, and then you lose all interest in the story. Mm-hmm. And as opposed to the ideas of, I forget which games I played where, you know, it's not so much levels, but you end up adding enough experience that you add like an extra die or something like that. But the higher your experience is, like, you get to a point that it becomes much more difficult to add that extra die because yeah. you've become from basic to medium to now expert. But that's one side of things. The other side of things is, like, I kind of like levels because it's an easy way to identify people's level of skill, if to use the word again. So how do you feel about this idea of leveling and leveling up and creating levels of stuff?
Your problem is easy to fix. Mm-hmm. A lot of games don't do it, or they do it weird, but because if you're doing a more fanciful kind of setting, you do always sort of want that there's no upper limit.
Mm-hmm.
Because especially, say, for like a pulp setting, evil Dr. Weird is going to blot out the sun. Well, holy crap, what the hell's the role needed for that? But there's that possibility that someone could. But what you do is you set things up, and this is where scaling becomes important at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Where to be competent at something might cost relatively few experience points.
Right.
To be really good at something, the cost goes up per level. To be like the world leader at something, the cost would be almost prohibitive for a yeah. player character.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next level, like superhuman, would be, don't even think it, like, say for a game, let's say 10 is superhuman, like that is your like mm-hmm. like Batman level. And to get 10 points costs 1,000,000 experience, and you're getting 3 a game.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck
yeah,
with
you've
that.
Just told the players you're not going to reach that level, but somebody else might. Somebody might have 11.
Mm-hmm.
And what you've done at that point, you've let your world be open. You've let your story be open. The possibility is there. It's out of reach of the players, and you've put that idea that a level 10 in something is almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And because those are the mechanics, that's tangible to the players. That's tangible to the participants. So if a guy shows up with a 10, they're like, holy crap, how the hell did he do that? He must be like a Mars mutant or you know, he drank the Kool-Aid or whatever, however he did it. You have to be careful, though, because what ends up in a lot of games, they'll set that upper limit, but it becomes attainable because some asshole in your group is always going to find a way to max out their whatever and then just be a huge pain in the butt. That's why I say if you want to have like level 10 is godlike, make it so technically it's possible, it ain't going to happen. That's fine. It's still in play. It's still tangible to the group, but it's not going to screw up your campaign. Yeah. Cause that gets to that idea that the mechanics, like I said, are the rules of the laws of physics. They're how the world works. If you've put that in there, you've now set up, yeah, that says something about your story and your setting.
No, and it begs to different, like, and this is where we have to start talking about things like, okay, so what are the levels? So mm-hmm. what are the basic levels of skill? So what is a human? Because then you have to start saying, well, what's an average human? Because then yeah. that's sort of like the low end of things. And then you start asking questions like, like, for example, why aren't there more role-playing games that use percentile dice to deal with resolutions for stuff? Because they're easy enough to come by. But most people want to roll a die 20 or a die 10 or a die 6 or a die 8 or something like that. Is there a particular reason? Like, can you think of any role-playing games that use something larger? Like, you'd think a larger die would give you a lot more options to be able to do stuff because of the gradients of numbers. You know, that 21 was okay, but a 22 would have done it. You know, like, I don't know.
It does. The problem when you have a percentage or any kind of system that it's a target number or lower
mm-hmm.
is even though you've got that like, we'll use the percent thing, there's still kind of an upper limit. Like 100 is still the maximum.
Right.
And if you fudge the numbers, because I've seen games that'll do that, they'll say use a percentage. And because, like, to have 98% and something is really high, average people will have, like, a 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Because that means, like, that means, like, 100% is something to aspire to. It's like that level 10. It's almost impossible to get there, but it's still possible.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the way things work when you do that, if everybody, like, 20% is, like, competent, that means people are only succeeding 1 times out of 5 over anything they try.
Right.
And different games will do things like, some will have a lot of modifiers, so doing something easy gives you, like, a plus 60.
Right.
So that's 80% success. The old FASA Star Trek game used to do a weird thing where everything was percentage.
I remember. I had the FASA. So you're right. That was a game that they used everything as percentage. Yeah.
And if you remember, though, you only made rolls for certain things. So if I had 10%, that was considered competent.
Right.
So I didn't have to roll to pilot the shuttle, only if I had to dodge phaser fire. And the problem was I'm not going to do it with a 10%.
Yeah.
And then 40 would be like main character level. And there would be more things that if I had a 40, I wouldn't bother rolling for because it's assumed I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
But then it got to that weird thing that, yeah, like if you're 40 is still more than half the time you're going to fail.
Right.
So if you're considered competent at something, as soon as it gets a little difficult, you're gonna fail, you're gonna suck. And it works, but it gives you a kind of, there's a lot that now you have to kind of monkey with. It's not a clean, easy to follow system, and you get those weird things where it doesn't quite connect up with the story.
And in some ways, and I've noticed this too, that it's almost anticlimactic for those role-playing systems where you have to roll under your numbers. Everybody's, you know, naturally you want to roll high numbers, and you get like these skill ones where there's like, yeah, you've got a skill of 15, so roll and see if you get under your skill. And yeah, you do it in the whole bit, and that's awesome, but there's this natural, maybe it's just from my age, but there's this natural tendency to want to roll, you know, I need that natural 20, you know what I mean, to make it happen. Have you found that's the case too, or?
Well, what happens is a lot of games will use like kind of an open-ended role,
mm-hmm.
because that way you can get bigger numbers. So you'll get like, DC Heroes is a good example. Cause in DC Heroes, I compare my chance to do something versus your chance to not have it done. And that's my number. I roll 2d20. If I roll double ones, that's a failure. If those come up at all, it just fails. If I roll double anything else, I can keep rolling and add to it.
Right.
And then the idea was every so many points, there was a chart. Every so many points, I'd get a column shift, which bumped up my level of success a degree.
Right.
And that changed so that 11 to 13, it's a 2 difference. I get a column shift. 13 to 15, another 2. But then it got to the point where every 5, I'd get a shift.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that I could get super massive, awesome success. Because sometimes, like, when you're Henry Pym in your basement, you invent Ultron. And sometimes you, like, invent really, like, mediocre growth power or whatever.
Right.
And it represented that weird superhero thing. Where you could have that breakthrough, you could have that weird success, you could that 1 in a million chance. And games will do that. That way you can have that bigger, more massive chance to just come in and totally wow everybody.
Well, that could be part of the, you know, another system that I found interesting is the idea that depending upon your skill ability, the higher your die you roll. So if you're somebody who's mundane, you roll die 4s. But if you're somebody who's competent, maybe you roll 6s. And if you're somebody who's expert, you roll 8s. And if you're somebody who's, you know, heroic in one way or another in that particular skill, you roll 10s.
Yeah,
is there a problem that comes inherently from that one too?
There can be, because you end up the difference between heroic and you suck is like usually, yeah, D4 or D12.
Right.
And the range of numbers that you have to hit for success isn't that great.
Right.
Because the more open-ended ones where you can just keep adding to your roll based on success, that's meant to be more heroic, and it represents that chance that, you know, buddy pulls it off. But it also puts you at the chance that Buddy gets lucky and it's really hard to explain what happened.
Right.
Like DC Heroes used to use the example that Superman is after the Penguin. So the Penguin picks up a rock, he throws it, he gets 23 column shifts. What can happen? We had that happen in a game that we played. which means when you modify his strength by like those column shifts, he knocks Superman out with a rock. Now, it's statistically deplorable
right.
that happens. But and now you have to explain it, and there's ways you could say, well, it wasn't a regular rock, it was the ancient rock of Amathulu that is mystically empowered, and that's what it did.
It just happened to have a fragment of kryptonite right in the center
yeah.
of it.
there's stuff like that that you can do, and if you've got like if the game master's on the ball, again, it goes to that idea of explaining success levels, except this takes it way far and makes it weird. Mm-hmm. A good example of that, there's a few games that if I'm doing, they use open-ended, and like say I'm a musician, mm-hmm. that if I make these lucky rolls and I keep adding to it and I make this god massive roll, I totally wow the audience with my performance. Which can happen, but if I've got really low music ability, it's hard to explain. It ends up being, I don't know if you ever saw Kids in the Hall?
Yes.
With the guy whose parents wanted him to take out the garbage and he just wanted to play guitar. And the devil shows up and challenges him to like a guitar playing thing. Have you ever seen that one?
Yeah.
And the devil's like, he's like, and he's like, and then like he's got the double headed guitar and two more hands comes up and he's playing these like crazy thrashing. And then you see the guy, E-E-G-E-E-G-A. And in the end, he wins because he pulls out a wah-wah pedal. So, and you end up with that kind of thing. And again, for a lot of games, that's perfectly fine. It's kind of funny. Mm-hmm. Funny works its way into game. We did like a whole episode on that.
Yeah.
It fits some stories because there's always that idea with your more dramatic thing that, yeah, you can do it. You can laugh it off. It becomes like this legendary story and it's fun.
Yeah.
But again, it's something you want to consider all of that stuff when you're putting your mechanics together.
Sure.
That do you want to have that possibility of this guy doing something way impossible? Or do you want to keep things kind of tamped down more? I don't want to say to reality.
Yeah.
But more to that idea that the laws of physics in your universe are less forgiving.
Right. Like it's you know, it's like the difference between Hawk the Slayer and Willow, right?
Yeah.
In temperament, right? Or what is it from the – oh, my God. I just went blank because it's late here at night. What's the very famous, like, everybody's favorite 80s superhero team and the Negative Zone? Or is it the Negative Zone? And he's the same actor who played RoboCop.
Oh, you're thinking Buckaroo Banzai.
Buckaroo Banzai, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, Buckaroo Banzai is an entirely different feel because it's a wink and a nod to the audience far more than you may want. You may want to play the pulp game a little more straight-laced, you know? You
yeah.
might want to play it a little more dirty that way. Because remember that you could still potentially play it very much as a noir piece.
Mm-hmm. And so then that goes to, you can add stuff or subtract stuff from your rules, because I think of GURPS. GURPS is, it's real life. Like, they start with real life and then they add the fantastic elements. And it tends to be very grounded in that respect.
Right.
When they did the Atomic Horror game, which is supposed to be your 1950s B movies, they add the science skill with an exclamation point. That's why I say it like that.
Of course.
And it represents that idea. To get the skill in the game, you have to have two science skills at a professional level.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be, I have botany and metallurgy. And then you take science, and that gives you a role to do anything scientific.
Right.
Because if you remember, that was like all the old B-movies worked like that. This is Bob. He's an atomic physicist. Well, we have to figure out how to make these plants grow faster. Well, radiation, right. Of course. Yeah, because that makes things big.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's something you add to the game to keep the feel. We did a... when we played GURPS, we added a whole load of stuff because we added toon rules.
Uh-huh.
If you wanted to play like Bugs Bunny. And it works really, it was a trait that you didn't take at the Game Master. We're playing toon. Everybody has this. And you got the wild takes skill.
Yes.
Which, however you wanted to bend the laws of physics, that'd be a difficulty. And then if you made your wild takes roll and you explain, well, you've just been hit with an autocannon. What do you do? Well, I go, bleh, my eyes bug out and I'm fine. Well, that's pretty damn hard. And if you make your pretty damn hard roll, you pull it off. So you can always do things like that. It just becomes a question of the rules put everybody on the same page and get everybody thinking along a certain way. And it's how do you want to do that to begin with? Because your basic rules are your default.
And that's what I think. I think like I like the idea that GURPS provides, you know, targets for people to think about. Like this is an easy task. Maybe that's what they need to be called as tasks, right? Yeah. And just identify an easy task, a moderate task, a hard task, an extremely hard task, an impossible slash galactic task, Galactus task, you know, like those kind of things so that you can sit there and you say, you know, well, I'm going to jump over the cement beam and do a cannon roll down the lawn and a cannonball down the lawn and then jump up in the to a spring up to my standing up position with my blasters drawn and shoot them all in the back of the head, right? Mm-hmm. So you're like, okay, well, the first thing is a trivial thing because you can jump over that. You got a strong enough thing. The next thing, well, we're stacking them now, right? So maybe it is trivial for you to just roll on the grass, but you're trying to do it faster, so maybe it's a little more. And eventually you're stacking all these trivial things so it becomes like a superhuman task. Marvel did stuff like that, didn't it?
Yeah.
They called them very specific things. It was sort of like a superhuman task and those kind of things in the Marvel role-playing game system, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And most success-based systems use a version of that. You know, like one success is required for an easy task.
Right.
You know, three success for a moderate task. A really difficult task might require six successes, that kind of thing.
So you roll separate successes.
Right. Although some success-based systems do allow things, like, for example, they say, well, one isn't easy, so if you've got at least two in the skill, on average, you're going to be able to pull it off. So the GM can just hand wave it and say, well, if it's easy for you, you just automatically succeed.
Right.
If you've got, like, double the number of dice per success, whatever, that you need. And then you only really need to roll when it's actually going to be really difficult for your character, when there's actually a challenge involved.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to identify here is okay, so what kind of dice are we going to use? And because they have to represent a nice spread of possibilities, and they also have to represent a nice spread of characters in or character abilities in the respect that you've got to have the mundanes all the way up to the heroics kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. D10. And there's a very simple reason for that.
Why is that?
Because you also need, if you're going to use a success-based system, you need something that is using really, really common dice that the players can get their hands on really easily because they're going to need a lot of them.
Okay. So why not D6 then? Because that's the most common dice you can find.
And many systems have done exactly that. Mm-hmm. That's why Shadowrun, for example, uses exactly that. There's a couple other GURPS. Systems that do that.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, GURPS does it a little differently, but yeah, they use D6s.
Space 1889. Travel.
Yeah. I know. But I mean success based games as opposed to like GURPS is adding them up.
Right.
They're not using success based.
Right.
And the answer is the D10 provides a wider variety. Mm-hmm. Going back to what you're talking about there, the one problem with D6s is it very easily there's only six possible options, so then each number has a much higher chance of appearing. Mm-hmm. You'll get a much wider variety. Also, you can kind of angle it with a kind of whole percentile thing when you're looking at a D10, you know, because it's basically increments of 10, so 10%, 20%. Okay, whereas with a D6, that's a little trickier to work with.
Right.
At least that's my take on it anyway. So it's either going to be D6 or D10. I lean towards D10 for the same reason I think World of Darkness did, which is with a success-based game, I find that gives the best range.
Okay.
Oh, but Don doesn't entirely agree, I know. But you're not going to pick D8s or D12s because those to get enough of them would be really expensive and problematic.
There's one weird caveat that I might say when it comes to picking what kind of dice you use. About mm-hmm. based on availability of dice. I don't know if that's a big problem because as a weird aside to that, mm-hmm. I am pretty sure that the My Little Pony role-playing game, which is aimed at like 6-7-year-old little girls, uses
right,
D4s
yeah.
and D8s and D6s and D10s and D20s and all that.
That's because it was written by nerds.
It was, but the fact that it's being marketed to 6-year-old little girls means that 6-year-old little girls have access to this stuff?
No, they don't. That's why the game was a commercial failure.
I don't know if it is. It's for sale everywhere, and they've put out a whole shitload of supplements for it.
Well, it being for sale everywhere just means that the suck copies weren't selling.
Can't believe we're...
This has got to be a rule somewhere that the longer you talk about something, eventually it turns into My Little Ponies.
Yeah, well,
there's rule 42 or something.
can't believe we're arguing this, but again, it's the idea too. If you're making a role playing game, gamers will get dice.
Yeah,
they will. But here's the thing: I think Jack wants us to appeal to non gamers too.
Sure.
And this is where we run into an interesting part. Actually, do you, Jack? I shouldn't make assumptions. Do you want gamers to play this or non gamers?
I'm hoping like. Again, this I want to open this up to people who've never played games before but love Biff Straker, the radio drama series, too, right? Mm-hmm. So ideally, I want anybody who enjoys the stories of Biff Straker to play this. Of course, it can be the idea is hopefully it'll be expanded as just the pulp system, right? Mm-hmm. So just like GURPS has its GURPS system, but it has its horror and it has its space and stuff like that. I'm going to try to playtest it, especially using Biff Straker, but I can see it running an entirely, you know, detective pulp mm-hmm. series or in something else. So, I don't know if that answers your question.
It pretty much does. I mean, then you're probably better to go with D6. Because D6 are something that anyone can get their hands on. People can even, like, normal non-gamer people can usually even scavenge a few up from, like, Monopoly sets or whatever else that they've got around the house.
Right.
So if you want, so unless you plan on packing dice with it and you're going to make them buy the dice separately, use a die that they can get their hands on in the house.
Fair enough.
I'd say maybe, but I'm going to still go with we have the internet. People can get die. If your system works better with some like a D30, for whatever reason, do a D30.
I don't argue with that, but I do think that the less barriers we create to play, the higher sales are going to be and the more happy people are going to be with
it. It's true. I mean, does your phone have a randomizer?
It does, and you can even get, like, dice rolling programs for your phone. I know you can, or your computer.
Problem solved.
you can do that. However, some people like the feel of the physical dice, and people are most likely to have D6 around the house, even if they're not gamers.
Yeah, but I'm...
It is the most common die in the world.
It is, but the D6 is, like Rob said, if you're using an individual one, you don't have a big spread. And if you're using a bunch of them and adding them, remember, mm-hmm. that turns your probability into a bell curve, which you may or may not want. Like, that works perfectly well, too. But you have to then keep in mind that you're not going to have a linear progression. Rolls are going to average out more around, like, 9 to 12 if you're doing, like, 3d6. If you're doing 2d6, rolls are going to average out, again, somewhere around 5 or 6. Like, those are going to come up way more often than, like, 2s or 12s. If you use 10 of them, then everything's going to average out somewhere between, it's been a long time, like, 26 and 34. So it's all kind of how you're setting your thing up. And that becomes the first tangible thing is, are you going to go with the open-ended thing where the higher your roll plus your stats or whatever, the better? Or are you going to go with a probability thing where your stats and skills give you the target number that you have to, like, say, roll lower than or roll higher than?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking you guys, what do you think is the best route to go with something like this? The D&D part of me loves the idea of, you know, oh, I got a natural 20 because you're going for something higher. Mm-hmm. But I also recognize that I've enjoyed playing games, too, where you're going under a particular number of your skill level. So you have to make the decision. What are the elements that that makes a successful, and maybe we need to focus on that first. What are the elements that make a successful role for some kind of encounter, or not an encounter, but some kind of task, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to do something, and maybe the combat system is a natural progression of that. Mm-hmm. But if we start with some kind of task is required for me to do. Maybe it's just I have to throw this rope up to my buddy.
Uh-huh.
What am I looking at? I'm looking at a target that I have to hit. I don't mean a target as in my buddy up there, but I mean a target number. Or am I looking at a target number of dice that I'm going to use to roll with a certain threshold that I have to hit?
Mm-hmm.
What makes the most sense? What is the easiest for people to be able to visualize, and what's the best for storytelling?
Yeah, there's another question that comes up with that too, is how do you handle character versus character?
Yeah.
And the example to put forth for that is DC Heroes. The difficulty of me punching you is based on my ability to punch, cross-referenced against your ability to be punched. Or to get out of the way, if you want to say.
So, to evade, yeah.
Yeah, so there's more interaction there. A game like Cyberpunk, my ability to shoot you is essentially based on how far away you are, because remember, the game is more grounded, more realistic, and in real life, you are not going to move fast enough to get away from my bullet.
Well, why don't we do this? Why don't we identify very specifically that a task is something that the character engages in that's not against another character.
Okay,
right? Or some sort of living creature.
Right.
Because you can attack monsters that are basically, you know, non-player characters too, right? Mm-hmm. But the DM or the GM or whatever, I was tentatively calling it Overlord just for my delusions of grandeur. they're going to be rolling for them, right?
Right.
But me throwing a rope up to hook a grappling hook up on the roof, theoretically, the roof isn't rolling back to see if it resists.
Right.
It really is a matter of how difficult is that texture of that roof to be able to hold on to the grapples, you know?
Right.
So is that a fair thing to say? Tasks are things that are non-living?
Yeah.
And combat is anything that's either man versus man, man versus animal, you know, character versus character.
Yeah, this is the thing, Jack. We're running into exactly how you want this to feel. That's the most important element, I think, anyway, here, is how you want this to feel. Do you want this to always be an element, there to always be an element of uncertainty?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want there to be very clear, well, I'm a master of this skill, so therefore, you know, when I use my, you know, throwing rope skill or whatever, I should easily be able to do it.
No, I like the idea of having potentials of minor failures and major failures and stuff like that, because that adds more to the storyline. Because if you take a look at a lot of pulp stories, you can say, oh, yeah, well, Flash Gordon, for example, if you watch the old serials, you can say, you know, he always wins in the end. He fails a whole lot before he gets to the end, right? You know, he takes over, but the wheel is damaged, and he crashes the ship, and everybody thinks he's dead. But no, he gets out just in time to do it. And he makes his way over here, but he falls down a sinkhole. You know what I mean? And so all these terrible things can possibly happen. They add to that tension of the story. If it's too certain, it's kind of lost that pulpy edge. because part of it is that cliffhanger-esque stuff, right? So I like the idea of I'm going to give this an attempt. And and this is one of the things I hated playing, and this is another kind of game, of course, and so it's definitively different. I didn't play a lot of wargaming games, but I did play like Mech Warrior with miniatures and stuff like that. And I found BattleTech. I found it eternally angering because I would sit there playing with a guy and he would, you know, put his hand on it like we were playing chess. And he'd count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Nope, can't get behind you that way. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And he'd do this for 10 minutes, right? And I'm thinking in my head, okay, I'm sorry, but if this were actually happening, you would be going, I'm going to try and make it as a mech on the field, right? Mm-hmm. And if I run out of time before I get there, too bad, right? Because that's really the realistic, adventurous side of these things. But those guys were playing it as if they were playing chess. They didn't care about the fact that this was more of a role play in that respect. I don't want to play that kind of status, that tactics kind of style in the same way.
Right.
I'd rather have it more cinematic, more action-oriented, more... It's pulp, right? It's pulp. You can't get away from that kind of flavor.
Okay, well...
In that case, I personally think you should go for a success-based system where, like World of Darkness uses, where you roll your dice and you count up the number of dice that you'll get a certain number. You know, like in the case of a D6, it would be 5 or a 6, for example. Shadowrun used this, if I remember right, as well. And you're just using the number of successes. And that's the number of successes is what you actually determine, because that allows for more variability in how well things go.
If I remember correctly, and I'm not trying to interrupt you, but I'm just trying to for clarity.
Yeah, go ahead.
I forgot to mention this. I despise Vampire the Masquerade because I really felt it was just a whole bunch of people wanting to wish they were part of Anne Rice's movie. I did enjoy Mage a whole lot. Mm-hmm. I love the probability aspect of Mage and like trying to come up with spells that didn't look like you were breaking the laws of reality. I thought that was a really clever thing. I kind of dug Changeling too, but I always like werewolves. So I wasn't totally against the World of Darkness thing. But if I remember correctly, you'd have like a skill maybe of 6 and you'd roll like 6 dice. And a certain level was all of the successes. Was it 5 or more?
6 or
something
or
like that?
Yeah.
6 or more?
6 or more.
6 or more. Yeah. And then you would count those up and that would identify like how many times you hit or would it identify more like the flavor of the amount of successes?
Yeah, like for combat in the old WOD system, when you hit somebody, like if I shoot you, the number of successes I got on my to hit you roll added to the damage, and the damage was the base number of dice, and then I rolled all of those, and every success I got on that was a level of damage, and as I recall, you got a stamina roll, and every success took one of my successes away.
Well, what if you had something like, let's say we're fighting you and I together, and you had a certain number of dice, and I had a certain number of dice to defend with, and you roll so many successes, and I roll so many successes, and they cancel each other out.
It's amazing.
But what ends up happening is I actually get more successes than you, and that means I can, like, do a riposte or, you know, like, flip it back upon you and end up injuring you even though I'm defending kind of thing. Does that make a sense, too?
Yeah, there were provisions for that in the game, but you needed certain skills in that. Like, if you're, like, a martial arts guy.
Yeah, you need a special skill to be able to do
because,
that.
Of course, I don't want to be sewed by World of Darkness. I want to come up with a system that's my own, too, So,
well, here, for what you're doing here, I can give you a totally thought-out system right now, and we can use it for stepping off point, I guess.
Cool.
Okay, sure.
So we got your stats. What's going to happen is the average human stat is a 5.
Okay.
5 is competent for a skill. 5 is like professional level.
Okay.
We're using D10s. You roll a D10, you add the stat, you add the skill. 10 is a basic success, which means the average person who's competent at something doing the average task with it is automatically going to succeed, roll or not.
Right.
You roll a D10. A 10 is always a correction. A 1 is always a failure.
Right.
A 10 lets you roll again, but remember, you might get a 1, and that's going to fail you. And then every 5 points higher than the difficulty that you needed to get adds a level of success.
Okay.
And the way it works is, if I don't make my roll, that's a failure. If I roll a 1, that's a really horrendous failure. If I roll my target, that's a success. If I roll target plus 5, that's a big success. Plus 10 is, oh my god, success. And then you can scale that up however you want.
Wait, how many dice are you rolling in this system?
One.
Just one? Yep. One D10?
That's and then I'm trying to do something to you, you take your chance not to have it done, and you roll. And it's the same idea. If I roll equal to you, I succeed. If I roll 5 higher than you, I really succeed. If I roll a 1, I fucking fail. You know, that kind of, and that's your basic system.
Cool.
And it works because the way you've sectioned your stats out, the body, mind, spirit, and then you've got your secondary ones of resolve, stamina, reflex, you can juggle those around so that stats will oppose stats.
Right. So just one second here. So, and again, it's because it's getting late on this side and my brain is going mush. Having those stats, how do they modify your rolls?
Well, your chance for success is going to be, you take the level for your attribute,
mm-hmm.
you add your level of skill, and then you add a D10. And the result is your number, your success.
And plus any character modifiers.
Yeah, and you can do character mods, situation mods. You can do stuff like you added a serendipity, which is kind of like luck.
Yeah.
You could say that that's something that I can add directly to the roll, in which right. case you can scale that way up. Like 10 points will give me like a success. You could say that each point of serendipity I spend lets me add a dice, a D10, to my roll, or
okay.
lets me re-roll, in which case you want to keep that number low, so maybe 1 to 3 would be what people... So it's enough that it's a big deal, it's very useful, but you don't want to spend it all because then it's done and you don't have your success. Like you don't have that option, but it gives you that little oomph.
That's kind of like Star Wars... Force points or something. What did they call it in Star Wars? Was that it? Force points?
Force, yes.
Yeah. So it's mm-hmm. like something really small that you had, but oh my god, if you really needed it, you yeah. needed to grab on hold to that outcropping thing after your father just cut off your hand. That's where you blow all your force points.
Yeah, and it represents, yeah. it gives you that story feel, because for the player to make That's that right. decision to spend them,
mm-hmm.
is a big deal, and it adds that gravity to the event That's in right. the game for the participants.
Yeah. And you can only spend yeah. them if you yell, "No, it's not true!"
Yes, exactly.
Sorry, I had to throw
I agree. I think any pulp game absolutely needs some kind of system yeah. like that. You have to have some kind of serendipity or love force points or whatever you want to call them. And... Actually, there's a weird idea. You could even have an unluck stat. Mm-hmm. Okay? And here's a weird thing. So, okay, for example, unluck might be something like this, because it could represent what Jack was talking about, the Flash Gordon earlier, where he's constantly having bad luck, uh-huh. okay? What you're doing is you get a bonus, okay? By taking dice of unluck, you get a bonus, but then it comes back, it gives you unluck dice that you have to, that affect you later on, either at the GM's whim or something else happens. So for example, when you really need to make that critical roll, you can kind of, what you're doing is you're basically borrowing karma from the karma bank, so to speak. So you're getting extra points when you really critically need it, but you're going to have to pay for it later on by having bad things happen.
What if
to you.
That's still serendipity, but you can go into the negative levels?
But you yeah. can go, so that'll
so,
work
so
too.
So you could burn serendipity. You could even have positive serendipity and you go, oh, but you can't make it unless you use one more. Oh, because that's going to put me in unluck for the next turn. So works. Once you get down to zero, into the minuses, mm-hmm. You right. have to use up that unluck the next time you use the skill Because the universe is always trying to bring you back to zero.
Hmm.
Right.
Does that sound
and
fair?
And that goes in with... That works. It sounds perfect. Yeah, and it fits in nicely with your whole body, mind, spirit imbalance thing, if you think about
for
that.
For sure, for sure.
That fits in perfect... That, you know, you, in, so it's really not a serendipity stat, it's a karma stat.
Hmm. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, it is.
Dude. yeah, So there you go. I mean, and that's so you can play with the rules of the universe, but you have to pay.
Oh, that's
you
right.
You have to pay up.
That's right. Right.
And maybe you have to do good things or do sacrifices or something to earn positive serendipity. Mm. You can't just get it automatically each game. You have to actually earn it.
That's right. I mean, serendipity could be also the result of like the end of a massive campaign.
Yeah, right? That you could do it that way too.
Too.
Yeah,
so you finally defeated the Nazi tigers of Mars's encroachment onto the Mercury summit, and by the way, that's going to happen.
yeah, of course.
And so by doing that, you absolutely gain a point of serendipity. I mean, one could argue that renown can add to your serendipity if it's positive renown in that respect, right?
So. Yeah,
right. Well, but you could make it even simpler than that. You can just simply say when the character does, you know, good things, it's the whole karma thing. When they do good things, they'll get points of serendipity. This is one of the things that encourages player behavior, right?
Right.
So, for example, now suddenly they have this reason they have to go out of their way to actually help other people.
Yeah, actually, renown would be a nice... Renown would be another stat that would be nice in a totally different way about, like, how valuable it is for you to be anonymous at times.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, if you've got really high renown, as soon as you walk in, it's like, oh my god, he's the savior of the Solar Imperium. He's here, yeah. Everybody. Let's get him a free place. And it's like, oh, damn, I'm supposed to sneak in and take this thing, right? But
well, yeah, exactly. You can't do that because you're too famous. Yeah.
And renown can change based upon setting as well, too. So
yep. you can...
You can what?
Oh.
Right, did I lose you?
Well, I was going to say, because renown is a tricky thing in game terms.
Mm-hmm.
You can make an actual stat, or because you had the idea of like positive, negative traits, you can make renown something like that.
Yep.
That not everybody would, because if it's a trait, then everybody has it to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
But it was natural, and like you were saying at the beginning, the pulp heroes, it's Doc Savage and those guys. And you could mm-hmm. you could make it a trait, and then it has specific things that it gives you and doesn't give you, and you could have positive or negative. You could have levels of it, levels of it that say work like a direct modifier. So you'd have renown 5, or you could have levels of it that do different things. So it's like renown. It's like universal renown. It's like godlike reputation. It's all kind of like Rob was saying. It's where do you want to direct the players, like what behavior
and
do you reward?
Renown would actually be really useful too if you want to play good or evil characters. So if you've got like really negative renown, that can add to, you know, your first reaction, like, oh my god, it's Marcus, you know, de evil coming. Didn't he try to blow up, like, one of my main villains, his name is Doyen, and he discovers that the monoliths on the planets, and spoilers, the monoliths on the planets are what's regulating the gravity, the Earth-like gravity, even on moons and planetoids. So it's Earth-like gravity everywhere. And so, just to mess with them, he finds a way to, like, totally reverse the gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody gets shot off the planets into the Ethereum, and they have to go around picking them up because they'll starve to death flying in this air, unable to do anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great little critical story, you know, with just like this rescue mission of getting people who are flying through the air, or sorry, falling through the air endlessly because they've just all been just shot out. You know, from that kind of thing. But that's the thing is, like, negative renown still means you could be recognized. And the fear that people present can provide, like, they run out of a store so you can ransack it. You know, like, stuff like that. So there can be, that's, again, part of the traits that, so, I mean, the body, mind, spirit aspect is good to give you... a centered aspect of your character, but all that flavor that we're talking about can be in those traits which could be identified as positive and negative.
Yeah. Right.
And changing, okay. ever changing based upon the choices of your characters.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you can do, well, and those will be the character modifiers I think you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And one thing you can do is, remember, they can be positive or negative. So let's say when you're creating your character, you get 10 points worth of character modifiers.
Okay.
And that can actually work very well because it means everyone's balanced. So even if I create a centaur, pirate, Amazonian warrior woman, I still only have those 10 points, so I'm going to have to put them into things like, centaur body or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then that will come into play, of course, when I'm, like, doing a back kick or whatever. You know, can run really fast, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it also lets me do things. You can also do things like, for example, they can get more than those 10 points, but they have to create other modifiers that are negatives instead of positives. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, if, for example, if I want to have 15 points worth of positive stuff, I'm going to have to come up with 5 points worth of negative modifiers as well, and to balance those out. And so maybe I'm allergic to peanuts or something, and that's like 1 point. Or maybe if I sent to a warrior woman, well, I can't get into small spaces, so that's worth like maybe 2 negative points. That kind of thing.
Oh, damn, not the jungle of peanuts again. I told you I can't go there.
Exactly. That's exactly right. We're not fighting in the peanut farm. That shit ain't happening, man.
That's right. So that's interesting. No, that's kind of cool. But so, I mean, if we're going for those kind of things, then that also helps for, like I said, for tasks, right?
Yeah.
Because you got to look at combat, you look at tasks. Because I didn't want to have two different ways of being able to resolve stuff. We should be able to resolve things in the same fashion. It
should be universal.
It just should be different. And I hate when they do that. When I was like, well, combat is resolved this way, but hand-to-hand is resolved this way, and tasks are resolved this way. And so in the same way, let's run through it. So how would you, using this system, how would you resolve building a submarine as a mad scientist?
Don? Your system, you tell me.
What I would probably do is have the player describe the submarine.
Mm-hmm.
And you can...
It's a two-person submarine. It's quite small, but I want to go to large, long depths. And I happen to have a lab that's based on an island, so I'm already set up to be able to put it in the water directly from where I'm at.
Okay, if we're using this system, I think the easiest way to do inventions would be... You pick the stats that the invention needs. A submarine is going to need body, so it's body. Right. Your base difficulty is equal to that stat, so I'm going to give it a body of 10 because I want it to be kind of durable. I don't want Buddy to be able to like kick it and it gets a hole. every feature that it has ups the difficulty. You can fudge that how you want, but we'll just say for now it ups it one level, so that's 5 points.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be submersible. We'll say that's 1 difficulty. If you want to be a stickler, you could say, but it's got to go with this tremendous depth. Well, that's another difficulty. So we're up to a difficulty of 20.
Now I'm going to throw in a torpedo tube that shoots 2 torpedoes.
Okay, so we say it's got a weapon system, and we might say every... That's another 5. And you might say every extra shot, just to make it pulpy, is +1. So 2 torpedoes, we're up to a difficulty of, 26 now?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to drop my dice, D10, add my mind, add my inventing skill or my inventing submarine skill or whichever is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
I need to roll 26 or higher to make the submarine. Well, the average person, if I'm a relatively smart guy, I got a 5 mind. I've got a 5. I'm a relatively competent submarine builder. That's 10. The most I can roll on that dice is 10, so 20, but then I get an extra roll. Mm-hmm. So I have to make a 10 on my dice plus 26. I have less than a 50% chance on that second dice, if I make the 10% chance on the first one, of making the roll to make this submarine.
Right. But don't forget, you already have a functioning lab that helps. So that might give you a bonus.
There's going to be time and equipment modifiers. Yes.
So, yeah. And you can do that. So the lab, say, lowers it a level. It's like either right. takes 5 off the difficulty or gives me a 5. I might also say, well, I saw Professor Zoom and he gave me the formula for the super underwater hydrogen engine. And that'll help. So that takes another level off. And what you're basically doing is every little extra BS tidbit that the player can add gives them a like bonus, which makes them coming up with stuff. If I make my roll straight. Now, this is, again, that's really tough to build that submarine for the average inventor. If I jack my mind up to 10 and I have 10 in the inventing skill, which is really high, I only have to roll a 6 or higher. That's like 50% that I knock off a sub.
But not to mention, you just opened up an opportunity of an actual game of let's go to Professor Zoom's Mountain of Doom to get these particular plans to make it easier, right? Yep. So suddenly you have an adventure to make your sub. That's kind of cool,
right?
That's the kind of thing I'm looking for, right? Is these opportunities that crop up in how you do things that allow the DM or the players to go, you know what? I think I need to do this, and that will make it easier for me. Can we take the adventure sideways for a bit?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And then it is. If you want with this system for doing damage, make it the same thing that what you're doing is. If I'm attacking you, like you've got reflex as a substat, you could use that for your base 2 hit. You could use body. I make my roll and hit, and it can be a difficulty based on range, or it could just be you make your reflex save versus my attack.
Mm-hmm.
What ends up happening is if you make it by more, you dodge. I don't hit you. If I make it by more, the amount that I succeed by is added to my damage roll. My damage roll, like say for punching you, is my body. You've got stamina as a substat. Use that as the resistance roll. So I'm making my body plus my successes plus D10. You're rolling stamina plus D10 plus any, if you've got anything else that might mitigate that. Like say you've got boxing at plus 2 and you say, well, that'll let you block a punch, so you can add that in. Every success that I make on my damage roll becomes a negative modifier to your stamina, or it could just be a regular tally. And when you've taken more negative modifier to your stamina than you have stamina, like at 0, you're out.
Oh, okay. And your stamina, like for the average person, is like 5 based upon...
Yeah.
Right? It's just like all the stats that are basic or average for 5. Okay, cool. Yeah. I like the idea of the negative modifier. I think you're going to have to write me little notes on these things. Because my brain is going. Or I'm going to have to wait desperately for when this posts. Mm. One of the two.
You can do either. There's a full audio recording of this, obviously.
Yes, of course.
So,
But you have it all the pieces. I only have my part. So I'll be sitting there listening for your answer very clearly, and there's this long 5-minute pause. Damn you, Don!
See, and this works out, and it's all like one mechanic that lets everything happen. And then, like looking at your sample character sheet, you've got like a shock value and a panic value.
Mm-hmm.
Now you don't need those because, like a panic check is going to be say just a resolve roll. Shock check could be like a spirit check. It could be a stamina check, depending on like what it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the advantage, like the body, spirit, mind thing. Like Rob said, it's kind of blah, but it does give you a lot to work with.
Yeah. I kind of look at it as a framework to hang stuff on rather than, you know, the entire character, right?
Yeah, and it gives you that, and this is where I said, like, the whole D10, 5, blah, blah, blah. It gives you that start. Like, when you're designing a game, come up with something pretty good. Don't overthink it. Get something that more or less works, and then just start playing it. Make up sample characters. Have the guys go through. Do all kinds of stuff. See what works and don't. Because for the most part, that's how you're going to come up with your final system, by seeing what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, because the biggest problem you get, of course, is you come up with a system and somebody knows how to... Because there are always going to be people who are going to game the system in one way or another.
Yeah.
And if the trick is to try to limit that to as much as possible,
yep.
right? Like, yep. I don't care who you are. If you're in D&D at playing second edition and you're not playing with psionics, you're an idiot. because, I mean, if that's what you want to do is create, like, really deadly characters... then give them psionic abilities of some sort, because if that's your whole purpose is to game the system, that's the best way to do it. Because psionics, right. unlike magic, you don't need, you know, you don't need to move properly, you don't need semantics, you don't need materials, the whole bit. In fact, in my D&D campaign, I made sure that all the wizards got together and created a league to go and kill every psionic person in the because they couldn't control them. So they sense. Either killed right. them or they actually put like a metal helmet over top of them like they did in the old Hercules cartoon, which negated their entire sonic abilities and just welded it to their head and went, oh, you don't want to die? Then you have to live like this for the rest of your life. Congratulations kind of thing. So
that's rather harsh. before you go, I have one suggestion.
Sure.
And this is something that I saw the old West End Star Wars game did this.
Right.
And the original Mechton did this. Is that because they were games that were focused towards a very specific style of play. So obviously the Star Wars and Mechton was towards like a pulpy anime, basically.
Right.
The original Mechton game. What they did is they basically had a specific set of skills that almost all characters were expected to have. Mm. Okay, so the skill list was actually mostly filled out because it was just a given that these are the skills that you find in almost every pulp adventure, or in this case, Star Wars adventure, of course. And now, mind you, so those skills were already on the list. Okay, now you may not actually have any points in those skills. You could decide that during your character creation. Those skills were kind of the default skills that it was expected that most characters were going to have. Like, for example, in this Bill Straker setting, everyone's going to have Blaster. So just the character sheet should probably have Blaster. It should literally just be on there. Does the character, or whatever ranged combat is. You know, pilot ship, okay, invent. You can literally put these skills right on the character sheet. This is my suggestion. And again, the player, if they choose, they can still have zero in that skill. That's fine. But these are skills that like 9 out of 10 of the characters in this setting are going to have anyway. So just put them right on the sheet. Don't just leave all the spots blank.
Yep.
And then leave a couple more spots for blank. Like, one suggestion is don't make this a high skill game. Like, don't plan on characters having like 50 skills. Try to keep them, maybe they only have like 10 skills, for example, and 5 of them are kind of the generic pulp skills that every pulp character has, then they can customize their character with the other 5, that kind of thing.
I was thinking, that's kind of like Space 1889's Cascade skills, right?
Yeah.
So what I like the idea, but what I would do is I would say everybody gets a gun. You pick the gun. Based upon right. the kind of thing, it could be a pulp noir adventure or a tech world, which is a noir adventure. So obviously you're not going to get a blaster unless you have like a really high inventive skill. And then you've got like the electric gun kind of thing. Right.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So but that way, if you say gun, that might give people more flexibility. And it's like, yeah, I'm going to have the pistol. No, I'm going to have like the 2-handed blaster rifle. And that's going to be my thing. But they all have some kind of gun weapon. And they all have some kind of blade weapon ability. They may not have it on them, but, you know, when they were a kid, their father taught them how to be able to use the flick knife. Because that's what good fathers do, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Does that sound right for you?
Yeah, that sounds fine. I mean, like I said, I like the idea of just automatically on their character sheet, there should be a few generic skills that every single character in a pulp game has.
For sure.
And they'll have their own, and you can even leave a little space where they're supposed to put in the details of exactly what this version is.
Sure.
Okay? Oh, you know, what their specialty is or whatever. And if they're not using their specialty, they can use that skill, but at a lesser level, maybe, or something like that.
Well, this is, well, like, I mean, other than we could, you know, we'd have to identify how many skill points somebody would have just to build their character. And that would take some thinking about, like, how many skills do you have and how many skill points are we going to start off with a character? I'm assuming that's what you do, is you start off with a base level of skill points.
I would suggest, this is just, okay, unless you want to get into min-maxing, mm-hmm. which is naturally going to happen. I come from the GURPS champions background, okay? I know how, we'll call it, universal skill points go, and they go badly in most cases. Not always. But Don's laughing for a reason, because he knows what I'm saying this. If you want to make this work, follow, I think West End Star Wars did this. Again, example. Have a certain number of skill points, or certain number of points, for each of the three major areas. Character modifiers, body, mind, and spirit, and skill, and your skills, okay?
Right.
And so, for example, you, as I said earlier, so maybe you have 10 points for character modifiers, okay? And you can arrange them however you want. But there's probably, for a beginning character, should be a limit, like maybe max of 3 in any one category, sure. or something like that, okay? Body, mind, spirit, let's say they have, and you want to go for an odd number so they can't quite perfectly balance, maybe 10 points, okay, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a max of 5 in any one category, which, of course, you could put 5 into, say, mind, but then you have 2 and 3 in the other two categories, that kind of thing. So you can make a character that's, like really powerful. So you've got your 10 points, and there's always going to be one attribute that's above the other two.
Right.
That if you use with 10 points, because they're never be exactly balanced between the three. So that way, there's always one area where that character's a little bit better, so it gives them a little more focus.
Okay.
Okay? And then with skills, perhaps, you can say, yeah, you have 20 points worth of skills, for example, that you can enter. And again, none can be above, say, level 3 again, and you have to divide them among these skills, and you could put them all into the base skills, but you probably should put them into also some of the other skills as well.
Right.
Okay? So I'm a big fan of doing it that way because, yeah, universal skill points go bad ways really fast. But so, for example, you can get character modifiers, but what people will start doing is they'll start coming up with all kind of stupid character modifiers.
Right.
As a way to just game the system and get extra points to put into, like, their attributes or their skills or other modifiers. And you don't want that. In fact, if you do let them take negative character modifiers for those, yeah, limit it to something like 5 points worth or something like that.
Yeah.
Definitely you need a limitation. You need a limited amount. That's my suggestion anyway for how to do it. You know, you have these three pools of points that go into the three different areas and keep them separate from each other. Don't go for universal points.
Okay.
There's an easier way.
There's an easier way? Okay, Don, go for
it. Okay, here's how I do it. Everybody starts with 15 skill points. You can have no mm-hmm. starting skill higher than +5. And there's right. two kinds of skills. And this is kind of what the West End Star Wars game did. There's two kinds of skills because there's skills like, say, pistol or punching mm-hmm. or climbing. Everybody can do that. Everybody can shoot. Like, realistically, no, what about your immediate actions and weapon jam, blah, blah, blah. It's pulp. Nobody cares. You pick it up, you point, you squeeze. That's going to be right. like, say, reflex plus skill level. If you don't have the skill, you got a 0. But everybody can do that.
Mm.
But you have.
Can we call it? Let's call it innate skills. Just
innate skills.
Yeah, you can do that. Okay. And then you've got skills that you have to have that skill to do. So maybe you want to say, inventing.
Good plan.
Not everybody can like build the electric gun. So if you don't have mm-hmm. the inventing skill, you don't get to try it. Or you can go the other way and you can say, no, inventing's innate. It's a pulp setting. Screw it. Make your mind check. It's just you're not going to make that 20 with your mind of 4. But you might, and then, you know, Bob the Moron somehow builds the ultimate electrical gun. It's the same thing like, say, piloting a spaceship. You might say that that's a necessary skill. If you don't have it, you don't get to roll. Or you might say, yeah, screw it, it's a reflex. Everybody gets a shot. Or you might kind of split the difference and say, we have to land it. Well, you don't know. Roll. If you roll, like, impossible, you know, make your 50, well, you make it.
Well, you can say that Bob the Moron can make the electric gun, but he has to take the negative of looking like Yahoo Sirius's hairstyle for the rest of the campaign.
Maybe. Right. So, are you just saying that for skills, Don? Or are you saying do you have a separate system for the attributes and modifiers as well? Or do you think those work the way I presented them?
It's kind of. In the middle, because I think if you're going to go with the D10 plus attribute plus skill plus modifier,
mm-hmm.
you don't have to worry about like thinking it over too much. But if you keep that scale down,
mm-hmm.
like if every game, you get X number of experience, and those let you buy another 10 levels of skills. Things get out of hand in a hurry. But if every game I can add like a plus one or a plus two to my skills, or if you do, like I said, that sliding scale, that it's one experience point, or you could do the superhero thing that your serendipity that you earn, you spend like luck or you spend like experience. And to get level like 1 to 5 is 1 point, 6 to 10 is like 2 points a level. 11 to 15 is 3 or 4, or you could say that it costs a number of points equal to the next level I'm going to buy. So level 6 costs 6 points.
Right.
And if through extraordinary play, you're only getting like, say, 1, 2, maybe 3 serendipity points, that you're going to want to maybe keep 1 or 2 for like luck check kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What you've now done is you keep that scale small. The players get a tidbit every game, but they're just by how the nature of progression works, not going to become massive.
So yeah. I like the idea. One of the things they did in D&D that I like is that you get experience bonuses based upon the character class that you are, sort of following your focus.
Right.
If there was a way, I think if there was a way in Pulp of sitting there saying like, you know, I don't want to hem people into like, you are the mad scientist or you are the, you know, plucky sidekick or you are the, you know, this kind of character. But I think that it'd be worthwhile for people to pick like, you know, a universal trait or focus of who, what they are. And that becomes the focus of their experience. So if you are the, you know, if you are the inventor, then you're going to get a bonus experience for inventing.
Right.
Right. Cause why not? You should be getting bonuses for the things that you are. If you are the strong jawed hero, then you're going to get a bonus for either talking a villain out of fighting or beating the crap out of him with your fists.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So those kinds of things. So there's got to be a way to, cause that encourages role play, right? That encourages people to be the, and I don't know what I'd call it. Right. But I'd call it, you know, like, that's where the, like the universe
archetype.
Yeah. Archetype. Okay. There you go. So
why not?
Yeah. Archetype. That sounds great. Maybe we pick a bunch of archetypes that are broad enough that they don't have to necessarily just be that, like maybe you look at the Awaken the Hero from Within kind of thing or something like that as a basis. You know that book?
Yeah, there's
Got it sitting right here actually. So Destroyer, Creator, Ruler, Magician, Sage and Fool, Innocent, Orphan, Warrior, Caregiver, Seeker, Lover. Now that doesn't exactly fit our thing, but you could certainly find words that are similar to that kind of idea, right? So, you know,
well,
agent of change,
okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, yeah, let the player make a choice, but I'm saying if you let the player make the choice that of what they're going to call their archetype and how they're going to get their experience, that can easily be gamed the system, right? I'm going
to
be the...
Well, it encourages people to play that archetype, though. Like, they'll get bonus experience for, like, the mad scientist character will get bonus experience at the end of the session. Maybe just 1 or 2 extra points of serendipity if we use that system.
Oh, and I...
For playing the mad scientist or for doing mad scientist stuff.
And that's why
maybe
I said...
they can even get some on the spot.
Yeah, but and that's why I said we have to come up with the archetypes first, right?
Nope.
Because
Of course.
You can't let them make up, like, the bubblegum warrior and every time they get gum... They get an extra bonus in serendipity, and they walk into a gum store, right? No, you know, like
you guys are overthinking it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is easy. Every character you have a one line description, and the game master will have to approve it because again, y'all, bubblegum warrior. Well, there's all kinds of ways you can interpret that. So if he beats a guy up while chewing gum, and the player prominently does something like makes popping gum noises or at one point blows a bubble in the guy's face and blinds him, and that I'd let him take it. But everybody has a one sentence description of their character, and if you play that during the game, you get a bonus point.
That makes sense.
And, sure. And it encourages, because that way players, you make the player think, you make the player's mind go.
Yeah.
And they come up with the something weird, and it's going to, because they're going to want that point, it's going to be have to be something noteworthy, like noticeable.
Right.
So if you come up with your character as Filthy Lucre, the Acadian pirate, and you say adventure-loving French-Canadian pirate, and during the game you speak in a bad accent the whole time, like that, it's time for the mayhem, n'est-ce pas? And you twiddle your imaginary mustache. Fuck it, you get the point. That was funny, you know. And what that also does is that lets the group tailor it how they want. So if they want the more comedic stuff, that's what the Game Master will approve. If they want to be more serious, dark, brooding agent of the night, they can do that. They can mix and match. It keeps the participants active. It gives them, like, what we're talking about. You make them do some actual, like, role-playing. You make them use their imagination. Mm. And they get a little Pavlovian treat at the end of the day for it.
Cool.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds good to me. So have we hit all the main elements?
Yeah.
The major ones, anyway, I think we have. We've gone from, we got attributes, we've got the character modifiers, we've got skills, we've got character creation. We've put in some things to encourage certain types of play, which I think is a big part of it. We got the roles. Yeah, I think we've got all the major stuff. I mean, you're going to have to figure out a whole lot of other little details and such, but I think you've got the major stuff in place. Yeah.
Awesome, guys.
Now it's just
thanks
scaling and trial and error. Like, what's what's the body rating of a wall? Well, you got to kind of figure out, you know, if an average
or if it matters. Yeah. I mean, you're gonna have to, you know, like I said, you may want to set up a system where it's a very rough, very, you know, very, it depends on the story kind of thing. It's just the GM just says, oh, it's probably this,
right?
And you just go with that. I mean, because you're going to have so many different environments, trying to categorize every kind of wall is a waste of time. And it's also not in the spirit of this kind of game, right?
Right. Right.
So it's just going to be about figuring out what how these things roughly work so that the GM can just kind of do it on the fly as needed.
I think if you had like a table, which basically sort of shows, you know, light, medium, and hard and extra hard and a bunch of examples.
Yeah.
Eventually the DM is going to be able to sit there and go, oh yeah, this kind of, this totally fits under like very light or trivial or whatever. Right. Mm-hmm. So.
Right.
Cool.
So congratulations, Jack. You now have at least the foundation for a role-playing game that I think you can probably work with. And, hopefully, maybe some point in the future, you can play test it. You can come back, and we can discuss how it all went, and we can do a follow up at some point.
That'd be awesome. That'd be fun. And then next time after I play test it, I can roll and see if actually I should thank you, or if I should curse you. Sorry.
Yeah,
thanks a lot, guys.
Could be a little bit of a little.
It's only a +5 curse. I've got 15 spirit. I ignore it.
There you go.
Awesome.
Thanks, guys. Okay.
No problem, Jack. Thanks to everyone for listening. We hope you found this at least mildly educational. And we hope you had as good a time listening to this as we did going through and just playing with all the possibilities. Because making role-playing games is a lot of fun. You just have to take it the right way. On that note, good night, everyone.
Good night.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you'd like to hear more or join the conversation, come visit us at obeythedna.com. You can also find us on iTunes or whatever fine podcast site forgot to lock their back door. So until next time, remember that to master the nerdly arts takes time, practice, and enough Coca-Cola to drop a rhino. See ya!